Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Okay, if you're involved in art or photography or writing or storytelling, if you plant gardens or design houses or plan towns or build buildings, if you like to cook up dishes and sew up clothes, if you're interested in sport or business, media or law, languages or technology, woodworking or signwriting, or if you just simply have a desire to change the world, then you're actually involved in what is called culture making. And I guess the key point is, what vision is driving you as you seek to create that culture around you? That's where Andy Crouch steps in. His book is called Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling. It's about how to make and change culture, something that's on a lot of our hearts. Andy, it's good to have you on Open House. Welcome.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I think we need to, first of all, define this word culture. It can be a little bit highfalutin, can't it? How do you define culture?
It is important to define, and you did a masterful job setting this up, because sometimes we think that culture is just, you know, what you might call high culture, which is really just the arts, and not even all of the arts, just certain kinds of the arts. Or we think of it as this very ethereal, vague thing, you know, it's like the water that fish swim in, but mm-hmm. Do we actually know what it is? When in fact, I think the best way to define culture is what human beings make of the world. Culture is a very tangible thing. It's about actual cultural artifacts, you know, archaeologists or anthropologists call them that. It's actual tangible creations that human beings make as they try to make sense of the meaning of life and the world that we find ourselves in. So it's what we make of the world in the sense of the actual stuff we make, mm-hmm. but it's also the sense we make, our attempt to make sense of a world that is at once both very beautiful and inviting and also troubling and even terrifying. How do we make sense of that? Well, that's all culture.
Mm. You go as far as saying that even making an omelet is actually kind of culture making to some degree.
Exactly. I say, you know, the egg is nature, but the omelet is culture. So when you make an omelet, as simple as that is, you're participating in a cultural history. There's a whole story to how we came to make omelets, but you're adding your own little piece of culture there, and you're not just eating, you know, a raw egg. Just be natural. But human beings, everywhere we find human beings, and in fact, this is how we know we've found human beings in the archaeological record, is when we see evidence of them taking something in the world and transforming it in some way and trying to make sense of it.
Yeah.
And that's really what all of us actually are doing every day in various ways.
Yes, and I think that's a really good way to explore it right from the outset, because most of us don't realize that we're culture makers. Like you said, we've kind of relegated that's the artist's job or the fashion designer's job or something. No, all of us, even if we shape a chair, as you also talk about in the book, you know, just building a chair. I mean, why do we build a chair the way we build a chair? It's actually, there's a whole history behind it, and yet we're actually taking it forward. Okay, now when we talk about culture, Christians in particular have a keen interest here, because Christians often talk about engaging culture, wanting to change it to become more in line with God's wishes for it. You have some problems with the typical ways that Christians often go about approaching culture, don't you?
Well, yes, I think that, unfortunately, for a host of reasons, Christians have sometimes found themselves, well, really very much on the defensive with respect to the cultures that they find themselves in. And, you know, there have been a series of postures that Christians have taken, I think particularly here in the United States. We got very good for a while at condemning culture. You know, we were very good at pointing out what was wrong with it. Then we took a slightly different approach and got very good at critiquing culture, which is to say we became expert analysts of it and sort of investigated it. But really, that stayed at a very academic level and a very sort of intellectual level. Now, there are other Christians who get very good at copying culture, mm-hmm. which is to say we take whatever mainstream culture is doing and we do it kind of... I don't know if you have this in Australia, but here in the U.S. we have these little fish emblems we put on things.
Yes, yes. Yep.
You know, they're kind of a marker that it's safe for Christian consumption. and to be honest, a lot of us, whether we're Christian or not, spend much of our time just consuming culture. We just sort of absorb it and take it in. And all of these, when you think about it, all these different postures, and there are probably some more we could name, essentially make us reactive. We're just waiting to see what culture does, and then we either just absorb it and consume it, or we condemn it and reject it, or something in the middle. But it's never about what could we contribute to culture? What could we actually cultivate that's already good in culture, and what could we create that's missing, in a way, in culture? And yet I think those postures of cultivating what's good and creating what doesn't exist yet are actually the truly human and truly productive things we can do in culture.
Mm. This is Open House right across Australia. Andy Crouch is with us, author of Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. So give me a practical illustration then. If we are living in a city, a town, a nation, and we do see aspects of the culture around us that we don't like, it might be the morality or whatever, instead of what you were saying before, condemning, critiquing, copying or consuming it, we want to create something else. Give me an illustration of what the approach of creating instead of condemning.
Well, let me pick a large-scale example of it, because I think it may be the easiest to see, although it's the hardest to do. Many Christians, specifically, are troubled by much of what the movie industry creates, mm-hmm. you know, Hollywood and its equivalents around the world. And if we're into condemning culture, then we'll go to a particularly objectionable movie and raise our protest signs and complain about it, which doesn't ever seem to have any real effect. In fact, it usually makes those movies more popular than they would have been otherwise.
Yeah, sure.
We could just analyze it. You know, we could go through these other alternatives, but really the truth is that the only way to really change the movie industry and to change what's shown on a screen on Friday night is to make a different movie that actually other people around us say, you know, that's a great movie. I want to tell my friends about that. I want to take them to it. I want to rent the DVD or what have you. Well, really, if you think about it, if we just condemn and complain, or if we just critique and analyze, and certainly if we just consume, nothing's going to change. But if we could put in the years of effort and training and apprenticeship and so forth that lead eventually to being able to make a different and better movie, that would actually lead to change.
Mm.
Now, of course, this is, you know, making a movie is probably one of the harder things to do in our world. It requires a lot of resources. It requires years of investment. And most of us won't do that. But the same principle actually applies, you know, right in my own town. If I see something that's sort of missing or inadequate in the culture of my town, if I just write letters to the editor of our town newspaper, I won't accomplish very much. But if I say, you know, it's part of my Christian calling to get involved here and to help perhaps create something new, I often think the best thing for us to do is just, first of all, figure out something that's already good that we could affirm. Because, unfortunately, Christians have become known as complainers, honestly. And we're known more by what we're against. And so it's good for us to start when we enter any cultural setting, really, whether it's Hollywood or our neighborhood, by saying, well, is there something here that I could really get behind that's already happening and become known as someone who's committed to that? And then that opens up a kind of a reservoir of trust, I think, for us to offer some new creativity that might be received.
That raises the whole issue of the Christian subculture in my mind. Now, I want to hold that thought and get to it in just a moment, because you might actually answer it on the way as we kind of explore the biblical vision of what culture could be. There is a kind of a grand vision of culture that is actually outlined in the Bible. Just start with the book of Genesis, the beginning of the Bible, and then we'll jump to the end, the book of Revelation. And what vision of culture making do you see within those pages?
Yeah, well, it is quite amazing, and this is something that, unfortunately, I don't think churches have emphasized enough. There is, in fact, a cultural story that is played out in the whole sweep of the Bible, and you could sum it up by calling it the garden to the city.
Mm-hmm.
The garden is Genesis, and when you think about it, of course, just like an omelet, is, you know, the egg is nature, but the omelet is culture. Well, the wilderness is nature, but a garden is a cultivated place. It's a place where someone has invested time and effort to create something beautiful and often useful and nourishing and so forth. And Genesis presents God as a gardener. That is to say, God, in the biblical view, is not removed from culture. And God doesn't want to just sort of ignore culture or to lift people out of culture, but actually God starts the human cultural project in a garden. and then commissions humanity to continue that project of, you know, making something of the world, making something of the garden, moving out, exploring the world, exploring all of its inherent created potential. So that's the garden. Well, at the culmination of this whole long, complex biblical history comes the other end of the book in Revelation, which is the city. And, of course, a city is an even more fully realized and complex cultural environment than a garden. And what we find in Revelation is, just as in Genesis, God gave a garden to primordial humanity, in Revelation, God's best gift, the best thing he can think to give a recreated, redeemed, and restored world, is in fact a city, which John calls the New Jerusalem, a new kind of city that is everything human cities could have been at their best. So that far from culture being sort of a distraction from, you know, spirituality or God's purposes for human individuals, in fact, culture is woven into the whole story from the beginning to the end. And so our cultural activity is not a diversion from what God wants human beings to do. It is actually fulfilling what God created human beings to do.
Very key point. That's very interesting. Now, of course, the event that is right in the middle of those two bookends is the death and resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah.
What are the cultural implications of that momentous event?
Well, you know what is quite remarkable when you think about it, and let's actually let's even set aside the question of exactly what happened on that Sunday morning, because Christians and non-Christians may not, in fact, do not agree. We're not, and some of us aren't sure. And yet I think we can all agree, just historically speaking, that whatever happened on that Sunday, whatever exactly caused Jesus' disciples to believe that he had in fact been raised from the dead, had the most far-reaching cultural effects, I would argue, of any event in history. Which is to say that at the moment when Christians believe God most decisively intervened in the world, to take on death himself, but then also to raise his son from death, that set off a chain of cultural events that has touched almost every human being that now lives in one way or another. And, you know, it creates the fact that you and I are talking right now across continents and oceans. We would not be having this conversation. This radio station in its current form would not exist, but many other things wouldn't exist. You know, Sundays and days of rest, the weekend would not exist without whatever happened on that Sunday. And so as a Christian, I would say the death and resurrection of Jesus really were the cultural linchpin or the hinge of history. And again, demonstrating that God does not absent himself from culture, but actually enters deeply enough into culture to suffer at the hands of the worst that culture can do, a terrible instrument of torture and execution, but also intervenes to offer hope right in the midst of history and in the midst of culture.
Yes, well, even going back to your original C's, you know, it shows that God himself didn't condemn the culture. Yes, he judges it, but doesn't condemn it, doesn't critique it, copy it, or consume it. He actually recreated it.
Wow, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Lovely. This is Open House Across the Nation. Andy Crouch is with us. We're talking about culture making. You might not realize it. It's not just simply the artists and the architects and the designers and the fashionistas of the world who actually make culture. It's actually you and me and everything little that we do, all the little things that we do. As Andy says, you know, even making an omelette is actually culture making. You're taking something that's natural and then you're turning it into something else. Take a listen to this clip that I just want to pull out here from an interview we did with Stephen Christian, who's the lead singer of alternative band Anne Boleyn. Listen to what he had to say.
For this record also, it was I know it sounds odd, but it was a giant relief to get off Tooth & Nail Records, because there I felt like I was faced with the Christian music world all the time, and people, you know, the Christian band stigma and all, everything that comes attached to it. But honestly, coming to the Universal Republic, I felt like at liberty to go wherever I felt, whatever I wanted to do. And so actually this has been the most spiritual, the most the record that has shared my faith the most.
Couldn't you have written the same kind of songs, though, the same kind of lyrics on a Christian label?
It was hard, because no, I don't feel like I could. I definitely would not have written this record if we were on Tooth & Nail. It would have, the Christian genre puts you in a box, and you know, there's a huge stigma attached to that in the United States, and so I kind of felt like, wow, where's the line? You know, like, where's the teeter? You know, I want to keep my faith and I want to practice my beliefs. But then again, I want to tour with bands like we have been with My Chemical Romance and Fall Out Boy. So if we get the stigma of a Christian band, you know, those opportunities might not always present themselves. But now that we're on a major label, I feel a lot less pressured, and I can be a lot more free to express, like, hey, this is what I believe, this is where I'm going to go in life, and this is what I'm going to do.
So there's Stephen Christian from Anne Boleyn saying that when he left his Christian record label and created the new album on a secular record label, he felt more freedom to actually create. Now, that raises this issue of how can we avoid, if what you're saying is true, that Christians are actually there to create culture rather than to condemn it or copy it or consume it, whatever, how do we avoid this whole idea then of creating a Christian subculture, the whole ghetto that we've talked about before, where we do have Christian movies and Christian music, and it's all kind of just, you know, our own little suburb, and we play it there and we stay there?
It's a crucial question, because unfortunately, even very well-intentioned, I think, Christian efforts to create culture have sometimes ended up being, I would say, captured by a subcultural tidal force. And part of it is the logic of the market. Certainly what happened here in the U.S. in the 1970s, we had all these musicians who, very much like the clip we just heard, wanted to go out and play for, you know, not just Christian audiences. But then the business logic of the music industry led producers to realize we can find a wonderful built-in audience among Christians. And that sort of gravitational pull lured people in who started out wanting to make music for everybody. They ended up making it for their fellow believers, basically. I think the key question when we set out to create culture as Christians specifically is, am I making this culture, or is it being consumed and purchased and enjoyed to insulate myself or protect myself from what's perceived as a contaminating or dangerous world, threatening world? Or am I really making it to engage fully with the world? I think that when artists say they feel more free on a secular label, I don't think that has to be the case. But the reason it is sometimes the case is that the Christian subculture has become about protection, protecting ourselves from certain themes or certain words or certain lifestyles, approaches to life. And if you think you need to be protected, well, the problem is that generates very thin and kind of pallid art. It just doesn't generate great music, great art. Great art comes from fully engaging the complexity of the world that we're in. And so it's not that Christians, or even, you know, Christian radio stations or publishers or music labels couldn't generate great, free, remarkable art that would be accessible to everyone, but often our motives are to protect ourselves from the world, and it's never going to be truly creative if that's what we're trying to do.
See, somebody would raise and say, well, look, you know, Christians are called to be holy, you know, set apart, different, not to, you know, kind of continually expose themselves to the nasty aspects of what often can be quite pagan cultures. So where would you go with that response to what you've just said?
It's a very fair question, and of course Jesus faced this as well, and there was a group that was very concerned, and in a very sincere way, with keeping holy in Jesus' time. Of course, they were called the Pharisees, and they ended up being real opponents of Jesus, because their definition of holy had to do, as Jesus put it, with cleansing the outside of the cup. It all had to do with what you touched, what you encountered, and it had very little to do with the heart. I certainly think it's right that as Christians, we, and indeed all people, I think, have this sense that sometimes there are some things that are not good for our heart to encounter over and over. And we have to be judicious about that. But when you're talking about creating culture, actually adding something, I think the last thing we need to worry about is contamination. It's the reverse, right? You know, people were afraid in Jesus' day of touching a leper because they were afraid that they would get leprosy. But when Jesus touched the leper, Jesus didn't get leprosy. The leper got what Jesus had, the wholeness, and you know, the Hebrew word is shalom, the peace that Jesus embodied. Well, when we enter culture as creators of culture, we don't have to worry about being contaminated by the world. But actually, the world around us, by God's grace, might become contaminated with a little bit of what we have. So I much prefer to take that approach. Now, that doesn't mean that I consume uncritically, but it means that when I create, I don't worry about keeping myself somehow insulated, as if that were really going to address the fundamental question, which is not what I, what comes in my eyes or what I touch, but it's what is in my heart and comes out of my heart.
Key thought. Okay, Andy, let's get practical then. How does one begin to do this thing that you call culture making? Give us some broad brush principles that a whole bunch of people listening to your words and saying, okay, I want to be a part of this. You know, what can we do from this point on?
Well, I think the most important thing to do is start where you are. You know, when we think about culture, we start talking about the culture, we do often think about things like movies and, you know, maybe the music industry. Well, some of us may work in those industries, and then that is where we are, and we should start there. Most of us don't. But most of us, for example, do live in a neighborhood of some sort. I mean, we may live in a rural area, we may live in a town or a city, but we live connected with some other people right around us. And that's where I would start, is actually asking, first of all, what is around me in the culture around me that is actually good, that if I don't help and others don't help contribute to keeping it good, some of that goodness will be lost? Because all culture has to be, if you will, conserved and preserved. And so the first thing I think we should all ask is, what could I take that's already good and help keep it good around me?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of very concrete things. You know, I live on a short little block. There's about 10 houses on our block. And once a year we have a block party, right? And that opportunity for people to meet their neighbors in a fairly isolating, kind of individualistic Western culture is a great, good thing. And if my family can contribute to that, we should. Then the second question I think we need to ask is there something missing here, something that isn't quite right, or something that is just not complete, that if I and a few other family or friends started creating something, we might actually be able to address some of what's missing?
Mm-hmm.
This could be something that's missing in your local school, or in the way that your town... you know, it can be very concrete, like zoning. You know, I'm not sure if this applies in Australia the way it does in the U.S., but we have choices to make about how we kind of use our land and how we create healthy environments for kids to play, mm-hmm. and for business to be done. Could we be part of creating a better way to do that? So I would think very local, and I'd also think in terms of who are the people, the handful of people who you could actually partner with in doing this, because no one creates culture by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It always takes at least two, usually more, to really create something that can be offered to the wider culture.
Mm. The one question we need to also cover before we leave you as well, when we've talked about these approaches of condemning, critiquing, copying, consuming, what you're saying is no, none of those, but creating. Do you think there is still a place, though, for what you might call a certain degree of protest or taking action about things, or like, you know, we were talking before about letter writing to the papers and those kinds of things on certain issues? Do you think there's still a role for that at all?
There certainly is, because let me put it this way. There is a difference between gestures and postures, or the many gestures that one uses as compared to the one posture that you basically have. I have kind of one posture. It's the way I carry myself in the world. And when I was a teenager and growing really fast, I would sort of be hunched over, and my mother would say, "No, Andrew, you need to watch your posture," you know. But of course, I have one posture, but I have many gestures. And I think that condemning, protest, critique, analysis, even imitation, which often you have to go through a phase of imitation to become expert in something,
mm-hmm.
and even consumption, these are all very appropriate gestures at particular moments or with particular cultural goods. The problem is when they become our posture. So if your posture is condemning, that means that basically that's the way you carry yourself, and it's almost the only thing you can think to do. Interestingly, though, if your posture is that of a creator, of someone who their basic attitude is, what can I contribute, what can I add, then you're actually free at appropriate times to make a gesture of critique or even a gesture of condemnation, and it carries more weight, you know. rather than just being written off as, well, you know, those Christians, they're always complaining. Instead, if we were known as, oh, no, those are the people who care about what's good in our community and who have created these really good things for our community, then on the rare occasions when we chose our words carefully and chose our issue carefully and said, you know, this is wrong, and we do protest and we can't let it go unspoken, I think we might actually find that we have more of a hearing at those moments if we're known for a posture of creativity.
Andy, our last 20 minutes together have got my mind, at the very least, firing in a whole heap of different directions, because I think what you've shared there can be applied to so many ventures, whether it be politics, whether it be art, whether it be community action or whatever. And I think that's the exciting aspect of what we've talked about there. So thanks so much for your time. It's been fascinating.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. And God bless you and your listeners in their cultivating and creating.
Yes. Well, we are all cultivators and creators. That's Andy Crouch, the author of Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling. You know, if you really do want to change the world, and certainly, you know, those of us who are Christians often talk about, you know, changing the world and engaging and changing the culture around us. What a good place to start with what Andy has just shared. You can catch it on the podcast again, theopenhouse.net.au, if you missed it, if you know somebody who needs to hear it. And the book is well worth the read, Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling. It's through IVP.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.